Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Welcome to the 2026 PGA Championship. Rex, you were in the media center at Aronimink Golf Club. I have since vacated the premises. I am hunkered down here at the Marriott in Philadelphia West, not just because I needed to record this podcast, but Rex, you and I will also be pounding out copy for the new Live From with Rex and Lav newsletter available. Sign up for this, golfchannel.com/Rex and Lav. You can follow the link there and sign up for the newsletter. We already have 1 million people in the database. Get involved. Get active. Going to have plenty of great copy for you coming on Thursday morning, Saturday morning, and a recap on Sunday morning. Rex, you and I are a little bit somber, a little bit sad at this point. We were supposed to have Austin Smotherman on the pod, friend of the program, great guy, making his major championship debut this week at the PGA. We're going to talk to him about the golf course, going to talk about what the process looks like for a player who's making his major championship debut, what the particular challenges of this golf course were going to be. Instead, had some technical difficulties. Austin will be on the pod next week to recap his experience, and also being a Dallas guy will help preview the Nelson. How are things going on Wednesday on the eve of this PGA?
I think, and you and I were having this conversation in our pre-production meeting, the idea that Wednesday at a major championship, even if there's tons of things going on in the world of golf, and right now there are tons of things going on in the world of golf, but I love it when we get to Wednesday, we finally start locking into the golf. I went out and walked a couple of holes during a practice round with Brant Snedeker this afternoon just to get a feel for the golf course. You were on Live From talking about holes, talking about hole locations, talking about rough, all of the things we love about it. And this is one of those outliers. I mean, the PGA Tour, quote, the Royal PGA Tour, was here back in 2018. So we have a little bit of an idea, but this feels like a little bit of a different animal. And there's the big unknown. The debate last night on Live From is the golf course going to hold up? Or is it going to hold up against the best players in the world? As a matter of fact, you and I both did a punch shot, and I picked the winning score somewhere, I think, around 15, 16 under par. Looking at the course, based on the conditions, we're probably going to get some rain tonight. It might be north of that. We might be looking at 20 under, which is what won it here last time in 2018 for the BMW Championship. So I love the idea that we finally get around to the golf.
And look, people are getting bent out of shape about the golf course and the setup, and we're certainly going to tackle that in this podcast. There's a lot to chew on in that debate that aired on Tuesday night on Live from the PGA Championship. They had Gil Hanse, who was charged with the renovation of Aronimink. I thought was very, very interesting, and I'm sure all the golf course wonks, all the architecture geeks ate it up as well, because there certainly is a debate. I'm not sure there's a right or wrong way, but it's one of the, I think, identities of the PGA Championship is that they do go to a variety of different golf courses, and just because it might be one-dimensional this week in terms of driving, there are other skill sets that are going to be accentuated and exaggerated with the style of play you're going to have at the PGA Championship. Before we get into all of that, before we get into some of the player storylines, they want to touch on a couple of the newsy items. On Wednesday, it was Terry Clark's turn for his first PGA of America address as the new CEO of the PGA. A couple of things to chew on there, Rex, from the Ryder Cup to the golf ball rollback. He was also asked a couple of times about if there's any thought of moving the PGA out of its May slot, potentially back to August, even moving the championship internationally. What was the biggest takeaway from Terry Clark, as well as Kerry Haig, the chief championships officer who was alongside to talk about the week?
That Terry is very savvy when it comes to the media, that he didn't say a whole heck of a lot. And look, if you're the brand new CEO coming into your first press conference at your first PGA championship, there's a lot of eyes on you. So I think he sort of rose the occasions in as much as he didn't really say much. As a matter of fact, my only takeaway was the PGA of America does not want bifurcation in the world of golf. We kind of knew that.
Very firm on that.
I think we kind of knew that. I felt like that was just something that was generally general knowledge for most people involved. But I think by and large, and I had a chance to talk with Terry a little bit after the press conference, I think he's coming into this job, let's say, well, eyes wide open, because he knows the challenges that the PGA of America faces, just not here at this championship, but certainly at the Ryder Cup. And I love the idea, and he sort of addressed this during the press conference, that he's listening right now. He's asking a lot of questions. And every time he made a joke that every time I ask a question, everyone thinks I'm jumping to a conclusion. One of them being, you know, he was kind of asking about the idea of, are we comfortable in this spot on the calendar in May. I wrote about this island last week because I had a chance to talk with Kerry Haig, the chief championships officer, about, from at least a golf course standpoint, with the PGA Tour going through this overhaul of its schedule. And we know that the PGA Tour schedule is going to change going forward, whether that's 2027 or 2028. Is this an opportunity for the PGA of America to maybe relocate back to August? Because I would make an argument, not a full-throated argument. I don't have a lot of bass in my voice when I do it. But if you're looking at a major championship that lacks an identity, and I think both you and I probably agree that there's not quite the identity here that you get at the other major championships, the one identity that it did have, at least throughout the course of my career, was Glory's Last Shot. And that was the last major of the season. It happened in August. You were going to be the last major championship before we started talking and thinking about the Masters all over again. Kerry Haig brought up a good point that for two reasons, he said that he didn't think that was an option. One, and I had kind of glossed over this, with Goff's return to the Olympics, because of that date, because of the agreements with the Olympic Committee, they would have to change their dates essentially once every 4 years anyway. You can't have a major event played in and around the Olympics when during the summer games. That's part of the agreement. So you're already up against it. And he said, from an agronomic point of view, from a grass-growing point of view, and I know that's boring, but all the challenges he faced, let's say this week at Aronimink, and we can touch on those. It's been really cold in the Northeast. They had frost up here just a few weeks ago. The grass isn't growing the way you would probably like. All of those things that you would face for the Northeast venues in May, it's even worse in August. He pointed out, in August, you're at the end of the season. The grass may be thick, but it's also stressed, and it's usually really, really hot. You have to keep it wet. You have to keep playoff
golf course. Weather delays, yeah.
Yeah, weather delays. It's 1,000 degrees. He pointed out that the members here at Aronimink have not played this golf course, I think, since November. Like, they are committed to this. And that's the best case scenario for a guy like Kerry Haig. So that one was kind of interesting to me, because that to me is the one talking point that makes sense. But when it applies to what Terry is doing as a CEO, I think he's doing the one thing that most people would agree that, yeah, that sounds about right. We saw the same thing out of Brian Rolapp when he took over the PGA Tour. He listened for a long time before he started talking.
Dude, he's a golf outsider, comes from the healthcare world, clearly a very savvy CEO. It at least seems like the PGA of America is in good hands. One other contributing factor, Rex, to why the PGA does like this May date is it works for the TV partners. You look at what's happening sort of with the sports landscape. You're in the second round. The NBA playoffs, the NHL playoffs are going on, but it's not quite as crowded as August. And so the TV partners certainly like it as well. Any move back to August would also be complicated, at least right now, by the $100 million FedEx Cup playoffs that the PGA Tour has. So yes, if this is potentially part of some big reimagining of the global golf calendar, sure, you can make that argument. It does not seem like that is something right now that the PGA is pushing for. Neither is a move internationally. Neither is a move to return to match play, as Michael Bamberger was quizzing Roy McIlroy on the origins and what the potential for that would be. One thing I would push back on, Rex, is this talking point that the PGA Championship lacks an identity. And you're exactly right that it does not have the branding or the marketing that it used to, which is Glory's Last Shot. And I would argue it's not quite as clear or dominant as the other major championships. You have the grandeur and the tradition of the Masters. You have the brutality and the difficulty of the US Open. You have the variability of the golf courses and the conditions with the Open Championship. I think the PGA Championship's identity is actually pretty clear, at least it is to me, and that's the strongest field in golf. It is the hardest golf tournament to win. Our friends at Data Golf have something called the X score, which keeps in mind sort of the size and the strength of a tournament. And the PGA Championship annually is the most difficult golf tournament to win. You have the 100 players, nearly all the top 100 players in the official World Golf Ranking. You might say, oh, that's now a flawed metric, that not all the best players are represented in the OWGR. Okay, the PGA of America also has the ability to issue special exemptions. And they've done so this year with the likes of Thomas Dietrich, David Puge, and Tom McKibben, who have played well on LIV Golf. They are capturing nearly all of the best players in the world and putting them in this 156-man field. And I think that's evident in the strong collection of winners that you have over the past decade, whether it's Brooks Koepka or Justin Thomas, Scottie Scheffler, Xander Schauffele. I mean, these are the best players of their generation, and they've all won this golf tournament over the past decade. I think that's a pretty strong proof of concept that the PGA Championship does have an identity, and it's a strength, and it's the depth.
It's a good bullet point. You're right. I mean, it's a good talking point if you're going to stand in front of the media. I see where you're coming from. I think we have the same conversation at the Players Championship. I think there's a couple of events over the course of the season. The U.S. Open, you're not going to have that conversation because you have so many qualifiers. And, of course, that's not going to factor in to strength of field. You can make the same argument at the Open Championship. The Masters, because of all the past champions that come in, and the Amateurs. So those all three of those fields are watered down by design, as opposed to the PGA Championship. So I get where you're coming from, but I'll go back to, and it was Scottie Scheffler, of all people, when he was sort of asked about this earlier in the week, he said the exact same things that you did. Look, all of these events have some sort of identity. The Masters, his line was, the Masters is the Masters, which I guess is his way of saying the grandeur, the tradition, the history, everything that goes into it. At the U.S. Open, it's the toughest test. It's a grind. You know you're going to get punched in the mouth. At the Open Championship, it's you against the elements, essentially. And that's, the RNA does a brilliant job of just letting the golf course be the golf course. They never juice it up. They never do anything silly. And then he goes, in the PGA, this is the PGA. Like, it was a very, like, okay, it's the PGA. It's a major. It's like an above ground pool. It's a pool. I mean, it's, if you want to sit here and talk about some of the things that make this event special. And look, you and I have a lot of friends with the PGA of America. They do a lot of hard work, and I don't want to disparage this, but if I asked you to rank the four majors, where are you putting the PGA?
But doesn't every, like, not every major can be viewed equally. I think back to tennis. And the Australian Open is generally considered to be the weakest of the Grand Slam events.
Not anymore.
That doesn't make it worse. No.
Not anymore. I would argue, and look, our friend Amy,
you have the French Open, you have the US Open, and you have Wimbledon. Those are three stronger men's tennis tournaments compared to the Australian Open, which is at the beginning of the year, and guys are sort of rounding into form.
I would argue to go to golfweek.com, and I normally don't point this, but Eamon Lynch, our colleague, did a brilliant job of pointing out how the PGA Championship can look at the Australian Open as sort of a paradigm of, oh, this is how you sort of weasel your way out of a corner that you might be backed into as far as an identity. The Australian Open has created an atmosphere, not just in Australia, but worldwide. They've sort of embraced the culture of Australia and made it part of their identity. I don't know how you possibly do that with an event that goes to a new venue every single year. That's another conversation. But he was using this as an example of what the new CEO could possibly do to give this an identity. I'm not sitting here and saying that it shouldn't be a major. I'm not sitting here and saying it's not a wonderful event. We have seen year in and year out, to your point, great finishes on great golf courses. But if you're going to compare it to the other three, and I would even say maybe the other four, if we're going to throw the Players Championship into the conversation, I think there is an identity problem at this event. You can say strongest field, but that's sort of a very vague, very esoteric thought.
I don't think it is vague. It is the strongest by any metric. It has the most top 100 players. It is its identity, is that it's the strongest and deepest 156. Man field.
They're weak at the bottom. I would point to the club pros, and this is no offense to the club pros, but they're weak at the bottom, just like every other major is weak at the bottom. I would point to and since Live Golf, we can sit and have a conversation about the Players Championship being the strongest field in golf. Clearly, it's not, because you don't have the Live players there. But as we sort of work our way out of that quagmire, which is, I think eventually we do get to a point that the Players' Championship suddenly does have all the best players in the world. I'm not quite sure that bullet point holds up.
Look, I like the PGA Championship in August. I think it made sense there. I understand why it's no longer in August. I don't mind it in May. I think the general cadence of this championship season, where you're having big tournaments from March now through August, if you're going to be including the Tour Championship at the end of the FedEx Cup playoffs, like, I think that rhythm and that cadence makes a lot of sense. I do think it's a little bit of a letdown when you have the biggest tournament of the year in the Masters, and this is the tournament that immediately follows it. Sort of the NASCAR model, where you're starting biggest. You have the Daytona 500s, the biggest NASCAR race of the year, and everything that follows it is a little bit of a disappointment, relatively speaking. It's the biggest audience of the year at the Masters. They're not going to have another golf tournament the rest of the year that you have the same number of eyeballs on it. It's always sort of worked in the old schedule, because you would have 2 months of a debrief or a decompression from the Masters to the U.S. Open, and then you had the branding around the PGA Championship. Nothing else has changed besides the date. they just slapped a pretty cool slogan on it with Glory's Last Shot, and everyone got excited. And you know, the same amount of energy. Maybe there's a little bit more desperation in August, knowing that it's your final chance to win a major championship. But I don't think anyone here in the field is feeling let down or like, oh, this is just PGA Championship. You know, I'd rather win one of the other ones. It all counts the same, Rex. Doesn't matter if you win the PGA or you win the Open Championship. We're going to have a worthy winner. And I think at the end of the week, there's still pride that you beat as many great players as you have in the field this week at Rodemack.
Oh, someone's going to hold a trophy on Sunday and be very proud of what they've accomplished. I mean, it's going to be a life-changing experience, more than likely, for someone who wins this major championship. I'm not trying to rob that at all from what the PGA Championship is. It has the history. It has everything that you want. My only argument is, since the move back to May, and there's a lot of good reasons why they moved it back from May, that it doesn't seem to, when it compared to the other three, have that one thing that sort of draws you in.
Yeah, unless you're not going to move it internationally, which they're not going to.
It's the Professional Golfers Association of America. I don't understand this conversation. Like, maybe, I don't know, maybe we can have a conversation about another tournament. I don't get this one.
Yeah, he needs to just meet with the marketing department, and maybe they can develop a new strategy, a new campaign, let it on strength and depth, which right now is the PGA of America's identity. All right, one of the biggest talking points this week has no doubt been the setup. And you look at the length of the golf course, it's what, 73-ish hundred yards. That makes it the second shortest PGA Championship venue since 2020. If you're familiar with this golf course, if you watched the BMW Championship back in 2018, I was at that golf tournament, Rex. I could not remember a single hole at Aronimate. The only thing I remember was the absolute deluge that descended upon Philadelphia. It ended up being a Monday finish. Keegan Bradley defeating Justin Rose in a playoff. By virtue of that performance, Justin Rose ascended to number one in the world for the first time. We also had the old, I think it was the AT&T National, won by Nick Watney back in 2010. We've also had a women's PGA, a senior PGA championship as well. After those tournaments, though, Rex, you had the removal of a bunch of trees as Gil Hanse, the renowned architect, was trying to restore the golf course to what Donald Ross had originally conjured up here. I think that sort of decision and move by Gil Hanse was put further under the microscope by Roy McIlroy, who described the strategy off the tee at Aronimink as virtually non-existent, where players are just grabbing driver and bashing away with reckless abandon. From there, it's getting interesting. From there, you have some pretty long, or maybe not long, it's dense and it's thick rough. It's certainly long in spots, but the greens, as is typical of Donald Ross designs, are absolutely diabolical. A lot of slope, a lot of speed, a lot of ridges, a lot of pockets. What have you made from the player comments this week, and what sort of test do you think the best players in the world are going to be facing this week at Aronimink?
Rory's not wrong. Like, maybe he said the quiet thing out loud, but he's not wrong. I just touched on the idea that Kerry Haig talked about Mother Nature and how the rough, as you pointed out, it's, you could catch a bad lie. According to Adam Scott, who I asked about this, he said you would have to be unlucky to catch a bad lie. More than likely than not, you're going to get a good lie from the rough. And based on what you just pointed out, a lot of players will tell you maybe they'd rather play from the rough because you take spin off the golf ball. And coming into these greens, maybe you like a little bit more release instead of what you would normally have when you're checking up shots from the fairway. And Rory can stand on every tee and just wail away. And so this led to, and I'm going to pull back, I really wish we could have gotten Austin Smotherman on to have him talk about this, but hopefully next week we'll be able to do it. I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit. In the Live From show, there was about an hour and a half long pre-production meeting, and most of it was based on trees. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've never heard grown men yell at each other the way Brandel Chambly and Rich Lerner and Paul McGinley and our boss Matt Haggerty yelled at each other about trees on a golf course. I swear I've never heard anything like this in my life. I don't really have an opinion on this, and I will leave it to the folks here at Aronimink who decided to take all those trees out to decide if it's the right thing for this particular golf course or not. I will go to Oakmont, who went through a very, very similar restoration many, many years
ago. By Gil Hanse.
By the same actual architect. And Bob Ford was sneaking trees out in the middle of the night, the legendary club pro there, trying to get the golf course back to what they thought it should be. I don't ever remember having this conversation about Oakmont. No one ever screamed that they took the all the trees out of the Oakmont and they've turned it into just a pitch and putt. That's, no one's ever saying that. This is a little bit different because of the yardage. It's kind of contained. You clearly can't stretch it out much. And I get what you're saying. And again, I'm going to lean into it. This seems like if we get the rain overnight tonight or Wednesday night that we're supposed to get, there's going to be a lot of birdies out there. I guess Kerry Hague and his crew can probably tuck some pins and protect the golf course a little bit. But these are still the best players in the world. And I will go back to, and this is me leaning into the tree conversation a little bit. Last week at Quail Hollow, I loved watching Rory launching crazy drives over trees, taking stupid angles. It's entertaining. And then on Saturday, when he didn't quite have complete control of his golf ball, it went sideways and he had shot a bad round. So to that point, I see where this argument is coming from. But man, talking about trees, that's tough.
Look, I have a lot of empathy for Gil Hanson and of these modern architects who are charged with restoring these classic venues, because there's a very fine line between making something that's challenging and fun for the membership. And again, these are the players who are paying a lot of money, members of this golf club, that are playing it almost every single day. So you need to create something that's fun and challenging for them while also trying to provide a really stiff challenge for the best players in the world, once a decade when they're coming through for a major championship. I do think what the tree removal does on this golf course is it reduces the recovery options, where if you have trees that are lined and you miss the fairway, at that point you either need to create something that could be pretty magical and you're taking out a little bit of risk, or you just sort of, you know, the old phrase, take your medicine, chop out and try to make your par that way. This week, I think, is going to be a little bit of a dumbed down version where there's a magic carry of 305 yards, it seems like, where if you can carry the ball 305 yards, you're able to clear some of the dog legs and you're able to clear some of the bunkers. Even if you're missing in the rough without trees, it's pretty simple and straightforward from there. I'm not saying it's simple and straightforward to get the ball close, but your recovery options are pretty simple and straightforward that you just sort of hack it and get a tumbler up near the green. Maybe you chase it into a front bunker, maybe you chase it over the back, or maybe you judge it right and you can land on the putting surface and keep it there. I think from that respect, it is uninteresting. What is, however, interesting about this golf course, and so if you take the one-dimensional aspect of the driving, and everyone is basically just hitting driver on every single hole, there's certainly a premium still for putting the ball in the fairway. Because as we mentioned, the greens have a lot of nuance to them and they have a lot of slope. And so being able to judge the spin and control the spin is going to give you, if you're going to have double the amount of wedge shots that you would typically have during the course of a PGA Tour round, all of a sudden, you can really have some green light specials because you're able to control it from the fairway. If all of a sudden you have so many wedges from the rough, yeah, maybe you get lucky. Maybe you can take some of the spin off, but it's just a lot harder to control. And so you're going to see a lot of wedges this week. You're going to see a big emphasis on spin control. You're going to see some really long, difficult putts over some of the ridges and the mounds. So lag putting, three putt avoidance are going to be important attributes as well. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer that it's not more of a driving test. Sure, I still think long and straight should be rewarded, but I think there's other aspects of this golf course, Rex, that I think are going to make for some pretty interesting viewing.
And I don't know why we immediately think that, okay, guys are going to shoot 15, 16, 17 under, and it's not a worthy test. I think Kerry Hague has historically done a brilliant job of creating a fair test. I mean, if you want to talk about the identity of the PGA Championship, I would say it's Kerry Hague. It's the players know that he's going to be fair. We're never going to show up at a PGA Championship worried that they're going to let the greens grow or the grass is going to be too long or something's going to be over the top on the golf course. That's simply not going to happen. He lets them shoot whatever it is the golf course of Mother Nature is going to allow for that particular week. So I'm not even caught up in what the winning score might be. And I know some are going to get caught up.
I could care less. What was Valhalla? I know that was wet and soggy and
could care less.
Nothing golf course. I think that was 21 under par.
Yeah. I mean, could care less. It really doesn't matter to me. And also, and this is not going to be popular. I don't particularly care if Aronimink is going to be in some sort of rotation for the PGA Championship or not. This goes to the larger conversation this week about the golf ball rollback and the game's elite players hit the ball too far. I don't think so. I'm entertained. And like, look, if we can't go to a golf course like Aronimink, which is a wonderful club, I've walked this golf course. It's such a cool golf course, but maybe it's just not up to host. As you pointed out, it's the second shortest in the last, what, 6 or 7 years to host a major championship or to host a PGA championship. Maybe it's just not there. Maybe you just don't have that option anymore. Maybe you host a PGA Tour championship.
But isn't that a shame? I think that's what the purists take great offense to, is that why do you have these cathedrals of the game, top 25, top 50 golf courses in the U.S., but all of a sudden they're rendered obsolete because equipment has been unregulated over the past couple of decades. I mean, you could make the argument that had there been stricter lockdowns on the golf ball or the driver head or shaft length, you know, the golf course would play as intended. You wouldn't be able to fly all these dog legs. You wouldn't be able to fly all these bunkers. All of a sudden you're tasked with playing position oriented golf on a golf course that you mentioned by today's standards is pretty short. If all of a sudden you're working around those doglegs and with the cambered fairways, that would be a better test of golf. And it's what Donald Ross originally intended more than a century ago.
I feel like that argument is a false equivalency. And here's why, because we keep leaning into the idea that it's all about the golf ball or it's all about the driver head. It's all about the length of the shaft. And that's certainly a large part of it, but it's also about bigger, stronger, faster. You and I both know the athletes on the PGA Tour are so much bigger and so much better conditions and so much more well-trained than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. I was having this conversation last week with Lucas Glover, and he said, when I came out on tour, and he's what, 6'3", 6'4"? He goes, I was the big person. I was the one everyone looked at and went, oh yeah, he'd be a linebacker if he decided to play football. He goes, I'm small now when you look at some of the players. Ludvig Åberg, just a towering specimen of a human being. We can keep going to Chris Reighton last week, just a towering specimen of a human being. They're bigger, stronger, faster. They're trained better. The teaching of the actual golf swing is better. Everything is optimized for distance. So I'm not buying this argument that had the governing body stepped in 20, 30 years ago, that we wouldn't be here. I still believe we would be at some version of where we are today, that we have this hand-wringing. I have nothing against Aronimink or any other club that might be outdated by this. But the fact of the matter is there are plenty of sports that have to move on from whatever it is the traditions were. And in this particular case, and this got thrown in my face by a colleague, Eamon Lynch, today, that, well, what happens at the old course? And my response was, all right, when someone shoots 58 at the old course, then we can have a conversation. That hasn't happened. And unless we get a crazy weather week next time we're there, I don't see it happening, because golf is still difficult, even if you hit it 350 yards.
Yeah, and look, the whole point of the golf ball rollback wasn't necessarily to uniformly cut down distance by 25 to 50 yards. It was essentially, at this point, band-aiding the situation to pause distance gains or at least slow them down. When it comes to the driver head, the point of a driver head reduction, yes, it would be some sort of distance loss, but it's more placing an importance and an emphasis once again on hitting the center of the club face and hitting it on the screws. Though you and I have massive difficulty hitting fairways, even with these 460cc drivers, the best players in the world do not. Their misses are still generally around the sweet spot, but they're getting away with it. So they're able to carry 305 yards, even if you're having off-center hits. That would be the purpose of a driver head reduction. If all of a sudden 305 is a carry that is only available to the Rorys and the Cam Youngs and the Aldrich Pottgeaters, players of that ilk, bigger, stronger, faster. I don't think anyone would have a problem with that. Distance has always been rewarded in golf. I don't think anyone has a problem with that. What has been reduced and is going to be apparent this week at Aronimink, I think, is that long and straight is no longer as important. If you're still able to spray it on this golf course and make a score, I think that's where you have some of the issues. You also mentioned, I think it was even on the preview podcast on Sunday, it has not been the most conducive growing season here in Philadelphia with some of the frost delays that we've had in the couple of weeks leading up to it. If the rough had been more penalizing and you had something that you had like at Oakmont last year where players are standing up on the tee and they're trembling because they know if you miss right or left of a fairway, it's essentially three quarters of a shot of a penalty for missing. It's not quite that severe. It's not quite that punishing this week at Aronimink. Again, I don't think anyone's going to feel gypped or anyone's going to feel like this is an inadequate major venue. It's just going to be different. It's going to be interesting. It's going to emphasize different skills. There's nothing wrong with that. We talked about identity with the PGA Championship. One of the identities is that you're going to a variety of different golf courses. Just because driving is not emphasized this week does not mean that's not going to happen next year at PGA Frisco. Again, I've got a feeling in a year's time, Rex, we're going to be talking a whole lot about PGA Frisco and what that golf course is going to be for major championship standards. All right, let's talk about some of the players in the field, some of the leading contenders. I think we first have to start with the Masters champion, Rory McIlroy, and an injury. It's pinky gate after completely dismissing. I don't even think we talked about it, Rex, on Sunday because Rory McIlroy himself dismissed it. He had a blister under the nail of his right pinky toe, was hobbling a little bit in Charlotte, did not play well on that Saturday, appeared just fine on Sunday, did not arrive to the golf course until Tuesday, showed everyone he was rejoicing in taking off his shoe and his sock to show everyone the blister, managed only three practice round holes on Tuesday, got out on the golf course on Wednesday. What is your level of concern as it relates to Rory and this issue? He ripped off the toenail, so at least it's begun the process of healing.
Ripped off the toenail. That's disgusting. I think my level of concern is marginally higher, percentage points higher. I don't know what you, if you want me to put a number on it. No, on Wednesday when listening to him talk about it at Quail Hollow, I was very dismissive of the idea. But this is back-to-back days now. He took a shoe off today during the practice round as well. He was hobbled a little bit, trying to find some shoe that's going to make it comfortable. My guess is it's not going to impact his swing whatsoever. But this is a difficult walking golf course. It's not Augusta National.
A lot of undulation, yeah.
There's a lot of hills out there. So when I did my picks for our punch shots, I actually wrote Rory first for a lot of different reasons. I think I told this story about being in a bar on Saturday night last week in Charlotte and Justin Rose's caddy telling me that this golf course is absolutely perfect for Rory for all the reasons that we just sort of pointed out. He loves a soft golf course that you can stand on a tee and just wail away and just go from there. If you find it, then he always has the advantage in situations like that. He has plenty in the tank to get to that 305 sort of golden mark that you talked about. I actually slipped him behind Scottie Scheffler, though, for the only reason is because of the toe. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but it is a tough walk. And anything that's going to take away your focus, anything that's going to keep you from preparing the way you want to prepare is always going to be a drawback for a player at that level.
Yeah, I tried to, you know, bring up the incident. Remember with John Rahm 2 years ago at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst? He had the cut in between two toes and it got infected and there was a lesion. Like, it was disgusting. That actually forced him to withdraw. I don't think we're on the level of severity with that as it relates to Rory McIlroy. Talking to Aaron Oberholzer, who was on the desk, he said, if you're going to have a blister on your foot, you should want it on that part of your foot and that foot in particular, your right foot. That's your load foot. Yes, you're driving off of it, but I think it would have been a little bit more complicated had he been driving into the left side, and that is where he had it. Yeah, I think it's going to be a pain tolerance issue. Is it going to be a nuisance? Is it going to be an irritant? It's probably going to hurt a little bit walking on this golf course, 7,300 yards, up and down some of those hills, but I'm not sure it was necessarily going to affect his performance. Where I think there could potentially be an impact, though, Rex, is with his preparation. And Rory did make a scouting trip up here two weeks ago, to see the golf course, played 18 holes, and then jetted back down to South Florida. But if he's only getting about 12 holes of prep on site this week, that is following a trend that we've seen him play very little golf in general over the past couple months on the PGA Tour, just 14 recorded rounds. He did say, Rex, this week that he would have played Doral for the Cadillac Championship had he not been invited to the state dinner at the White House. That is the week that he ended up going to Aronimink. And so we saw what he did last week at Quail Hollow, led the field in driving, but he was sloppy on and around the greens. I do wonder a little bit if his touch and his feel will be at all diminished or compromised just because of the lack of on-course work that he has had in the run-up. Again, we talked about how important lag putting is going to be. You're going to have 40, 50 footers where you're navigating some of these slopes. And he's not been a great putting season at least statistically, for Rory McIlroy on the PGA Tour, the Masters, where he did putt well, is not in part of those numbers. But sort of putting at length outside of 15 feet, I couldn't believe this when I looked it up earlier. Rory McIlroy outside of 15 feet this year has made just 7 total putts. So I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch for Rory this week with his putting.
And I will say that, look, his limited practice, his limited preparation is certainly part of this. And there was rust last week. In my mind, that's the bigger deal, that you saw parts of both his long game and his short game. That, look, he only played twice, I think, in a 7-week stretch. So he had just taken time away from the game. I think when you don't do that, when you quote-unquote don't have the scorecard in your back pocket, you lose a little bit of that edge, and it takes a little bit to get it back. However, when it comes to preparation for this golf course, he played here in 2018. He finished 5th. On this golf course. I don't think that's going to be the issue.
How about, Scottie Scheffler or Cameron Young? Which of those players do you have more faith in contending this week at the PGA?
I think it's got to be Scottie Scheffler, and this is nothing against Cameron Young. We're sort of splitting very degrees here because both of them are playing amazing golf. But I think we ran, and I think it was when you were on the show, live from to this point last year and to this point right now this year, he's virtually at the exact same moment in time. He has won once. I think he actually has more top 3 or top 5 finishes, whatever the case may be. He's coming off of 3 consecutive runner-up finishes on the PGA Tour. And we all know what he did from this point going forward. I'm not saying he's going to win 4 more times the rest of the season. That's really tough to do on the PGA Tour with the competitions you have. But I just think this golf course sets up so well for him. I think he's been playing so well. And we keep talking about what's wrong with Scottie Scheffler. Well, we can pick it apart, and clearly his putting in round 1 has been the issue, at least if you're going to break it down statistically. But everything else is certainly right there. I did love that Brandel Chamblee brought up the idea that statistically this is his worst year in quite a while, at least in since his first year or two on the PGA Tour. And he is still head and shoulders above everyone else. So I would always lean into Scottie Scheffler in this situation, especially on this golf course.
Even if statistically he's fallen off in a couple of categories overall, when you zoom out, he's still first in strokes gained total. He's still first in birdie average, still first in bogey avoidance among the other statistics that Scottie Scheffler leads. I will be keying in on, Rex, his Thursday performance in particular. You and I have talked about on the show a couple of times now how his first round scoring average is 3 shots higher than his second round scoring average. To me, it feels like a statistical oddity. It feels like an anomaly. Scottie Scheffler has led the PGA Tour in opening round scoring average each of the past 3 years. As you mentioned, putting sort of the main culprit for that. But he talked about it on Tuesday. He's simply spotting the top players in the world who are, again, playing some of their best form of their careers, just too many shots at the halfway point and having to make it up, whether it's spotting Rory McIlroy 12 shots at the Masters, finishing 2nd there. Whether it's 7 shots back of Matt Fitzpatrick at Harbortown, ends up losing in a playoff there. He was 7 shots at the halfway point, the Cadillac Championship at Doral, to Cameron Young. Couldn't quite make up the deficit and end up getting lapped up by Cam Young. But not all runner-up finishes are created equal. With a better start, I think he would certainly be in better position. I think iron play-wise, everyone's focusing on the strokes gained numbered, everyone focusing on the proximity to the hole, and how can Scottie Scheffler, the great Scottie Scheffler, arguably the best iron player, it's indisputable at this point, the best iron player we have seen since Tiger Woods, how can he be 144th on the PGA Tour in proximity to the hole when last year he was first? Just dig a little deeper, folks. It is negligible difference for Scottie Scheffler inside 150 yards, which is going to be his personal playground this week at Adirondack for the PGA Championship. All of those numbers are inflated because of what he has done, I think, sort of abnormally outside of 200 yards. He's not going to have those shots. You have a couple of long par threes. Scottie Scheffler is a great par three performer typically. All of those numbers are based on what he's doing on par fives and trying to reach the green in 2 shots. 100 inside 150 yards, he's like a foot or 2 difference year over year. He's still going to be giving himself ample opportunities. If you're going to trust any player with a wedge in his hand right now, who are you taking? Rory McIlroy, Scottie Scheffler, or Cameron Young? Of course you're taking Scottie Scheffler with a wedge in his hands. How about some of the live boys, Rex, who have been in the headlines this over the past couple months? John Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, Cam Smith's got a new swing coach in Claude Harmon. David Puge, Thomas Dietrich, been playing well at times on the LIV circuit. Do you think that will be a storyline this week? And of Bryson and John Rahm, who do you find the most intriguing?
Well, Bryson is always the most intriguing. You can just don't even have to put LIV Golf in there. I just think, period, in all of golf, simply because he's so polarizing now, everything. He's always been an entertaining part of the game just because of the way he goes about trying to play it at the level that he wants to play it at. Watching him on the range today is like watching just chaos in motion. He's got so many people around him. He's got so many devices. It seems like he's just working himself up into a ladder every single time he's on one of these range sessions. I don't have very high expectations for a lot of different reasons. I don't think this golf course is going to set up particularly well for him, even with the way he's able to hit the golf ball. I don't think he's playing particularly well right now at the moment, even though
he just finished third and shot 19 under par.
Even though he's had some success on LIV Golf. Thanks for letting me get that out. I appreciate you being a good teammate there. Yeah, I just think that John Rahm probably is going to be of that group. He's the one that really stands out to me for the way he's played this season on LIV Golf. The idea of how he just seems more and more locked in. Some of the comments that he had earlier this week about he's kind of resigned to whatever his plight is going to be on LIV Golf. He doesn't seem to be worked up over it at this point. Like, look, man, I'm under contract, so I'm just going to continue to do whatever it is I can do. I'd love to have some options, but I just don't have any right now. And certainly they have a ton of young players. I always love watching Joaquin Niemann play because there was a time when he was the one player that went to LIV and just seemed like he was getting better and better and better. He's kind of fallen off. Like, I think he's in a bit of a slump this season. And the young players, like, we just don't know now that there does seem to be this crack in the armor that was LIV Golf. Now that we're having these conversations about all of them, that is there going to come a time when some of them want to come back or some of them want to come to the PGA Tour for the first time? Tom McKibben, some of these younger players, it's going to be interesting to watch these players because I think they were all potential stars in the making. And as we've had this conversation before, the PGA Tour is the playground for that. It is an opportunity for them to come and shine if they do decide to go that route. I'm going to be particularly fascinated by any of the LIV guys who play well this week.
Yeah, I think I wrote in our punch out that's up now on golfchannel.com. I'm not sure Bryson has ever been a bigger question mark. I find what he has done this season competitively really confusing. He had back-to-back wins on LIV. He looked like he was in great form, obviously, heading into the Masters, and then a surprising miscut there after what he'd done the past couple years where it seemed like he had figured it out. He had the wrist issue in Mexico. Even last week, he alluded to a shoulder issue that he's been dealing with since the Ryder Cup that's actually caused him so much concern that he had needed an MRI exam just to make sure everything was structurally okay. As I mentioned, he finished third last week in Virginia. What sort of Bryson, what sort of form are we going to see? The disparity between major championships and his LIV Golf season has certainly been quite a disparity there. And where is his headspace? You know, what I know about professional golfers is that most tend to thrive when things are clear-headed and things are calm off the golf course. Bryson's not most players. And I think we're going to find out this week whether he can thrive amid the chaos, which is his uncertain future in competitive golf, whether it's on LIV, whether it's on the PGA Tour, or whether it's over on YouTube. Also, very interested to see what John Rahm has to do. He was very vague leaving the Masters. He was very confident, despite a finish outside the top 30, that he'd stumbled upon something or discovered something or found something in his preparation, did not want to reveal what it was going to be, did not want to elaborate about what that is. This is put up or shut up time for John Rahm. This is a great opportunity for him to show that he is still a great player, even if statistically it is obvious, clear and obvious, that he is not the same player that he was pre-2024 before he joined LIV Golf. This is a great opportunity, a ballpark that should fit with his driving and his wedge play. It should fit John Rahm's game. All right, without further ado, Rex, give us your winner this week and the winning score.
I went with Scottie Scheffler for the reasons that I've already kind of talked about. I just love the way he's playing the game right now. And again, despite or maybe because of the ongoing conversation of what's wrong with Scottie Scheffler, nothing is wrong with Scottie Scheffler. I guess you could say golf is wrong with Scottie Scheffler, that it's not easy to win on the PGA Tour. Yeah, like, and we've been here before. Again, that graphic absolutely blew me away that he's at essentially the exact same spot he was at this point last season. And I'm sure that we were having this exact same conversation about him. And I just love sort of how he is almost able to be under the radar. Listening to his press conference earlier this week, that is about as the most relaxed as I've seen Scotty in a long time. We sort of talked about why is he on edge. There was sort of an exchange with a reporter at the Masters that we sort of talked about there. I don't think you see any of that. I think he's in a really good spot right now. He's rested. He knows his game is in a good spot. Winning score, I went for with 15, 16 under. I'm not going to be surprised if it goes north of that.
Yeah, I'm with you. A couple of long shot sleepers if you're filling out your PGA Championship pool. I like a Sam Burns, a Jacob Bridgman. You look at what has proven to be successful over the past couple of tournaments. Adironimink putting. All three of the recent winners were top three in strokes gained putting. Jacob Bridgman, one of the best putters on the PGA Tour. Patrick Cantlay, I would throw in that category as well, the way he has trended with his ball striking over his past couple of tournament starts. All that to say, Rex, I'm with you. I'm taking Scottie Scheffler as well. As we started this program and you and I got into a long debate, this is the most difficult tournament to win. Data Golf's X score puts the PGA Championship at its highest, based on the strength and the size of the field. With that in mind, I'm taking the best player, and I think he'll do so at 16 under par, but I'm with you. If there are more than just a quarter inch of rain, is which last projection that is expected to fall in the Philadelphia area, I think 16 under par or around there is the likely winning score. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. A couple of reminders, we're going to be doing mini pods after the first three rounds. It will be going live on YouTube and the Golf Channel YouTube page. Make sure you guys check that out. Probably do that towards the end of the completion of each round, even if it has not officially ended. Rex and I will also be cranking out three newsletters over the next couple of days. You guys can sign up for that at golfchannel.com/Rex and Lav. And on Sunday night, as always, we will do the 52-minute made-for-TV edition that will be airing on Golf Channel on Monday. In the meantime, you guys know the drill, golfchannel.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys at the opening round of the PGA Championship.